Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Hello, my friends. Greetings, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I am your host, Michael J. Arbouet. But that word, quiddituzz, that Latin word, what does it mean? Adriana, please give them the definition.
Quiddituzz, Latin, the whatness of a thing, the essential nature of something, the quality that makes a thing what it is.
Yes, quiddituzz is the whatness or essence of a thing or a person. And in this episode, I want to talk about finding your calling. What is your calling? It's what you love to do. It's what you're good at. It's something that makes a difference. Sometimes it feels like it's what you were put on this earth to do. Finding your calling unlocks a brand new level of passion and purpose. And it's very rare that we find our calling. And I don't know if my next guest has found her calling, but she definitely is doing something that is not what she's known to do. We're all meant to do something on this planet, something that calls us. So whether it's your dream, if you want to call it your dream, whether it's your passion, or if you want to call it your passion, you have to do that thing that drives you. And that reminds me of a quote by Stephen King. And that quote is, if God gives you something you can do, why in God's name wouldn't you do it? And isn't that true? Do the thing that you're passionate about, like my next guest. Like I said, my next guest, she started out as a comedian. As far as I know, she still is a comedian. She's a very funny person that I've known for a while now. But she's also following her calling. She's running for New York City mayor. And, you know, a lot of people haven't even heard of her. But you're going to find out about her in a minute. And this week, as people are getting ready to vote, if you live in New York City, you know, they have that new voting system. Make her your third or fourth choice. You know, you never know. Maybe the fates will bow towards her and she'll become someone of contention. So without further ado, let me welcome to the show, Stacy Prussman. Stacy, hey, how you doing?
Good, nice to see you. I put my jacket on.
So as you know, the name of this show is called The Quiddituzz Factor. And I always like to start the show off by asking this first question, which is, when you were like 8 or 9 years old, did you always want to be a comedian? What did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, when I was, I didn't want to be a comedian, or I didn't even really know what a comedian was at 8 or 9, but I did want to be an actor, or an actress, whatever people call it nowadays, someone who portrayed other people was something I always wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I did plays, I did musical theater, I sang. I thought I was a much better singer back then. So I was basically a performer since I was like a kid, basically. Mm-hmm. And from there on, I just started doing stand-up.
Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit and go into like your college years. What did you study in college and what school did you go
theater.
To?
I studied theater. I majored in theater. I minored in theater. I went to SUNY Albany, State University of New York at Albany. So I'm a New York state graduate. And then I went then I graduated, and then I basically pounded the pavements, as they do. And it took me a couple of years to get my footing. And then I did plays. I did a well-known off-Broadway play in the 90s called Grandma Sylvia's Funeral. And then I did a couple of films, and then I started doing stand-up right after 9/11, like that year, like the 2002 after 9/11.
So after 9/11, you started doing comedy. Was that just to make other people laugh, or was it just a change from acting, or were you still doing acting at the same time?
I was always doing acting. I never stopped doing acting. What happened was I bumped into a friend, two different friends over the years. They're like, you should do stand-up, because I was doing improvisational comedy. So it wasn't like something out of the ordinary, because the plays I would get cast in were funny. They were all comedies. They were just written for me, opposed to me writing my own material. So then I basically started doing my own material. You know, I got up on stage, I bumped into a friend in March, actually, this is probably my 19th year. this month, probably March 8th, I believe, is my anniversary. So it happened a couple of days ago. So yeah, and I just got up on stage and started doing it. That's what happened.
Wow. So tell me about your first like acting job and then what led into comedy. Because I did comedy in college and I do impersonations, but I find it very, you know, I could do small shows, but as the crowds got bigger, I got more nervous and it's very, you know, it's very hard to deal with hecklers and, and, you know, people who just want to like come at you. So how do you deal with all that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just felt comfortable doing it. I was in an interactive show. So when I did Grandma Sylvie's funeral, it was interactive. And so that kind of helped a little bit. I was actually always talking to people in character as this character Dory I played for many years. And I think that helped a lot when I actually started doing stand up. And if I got heckled, I was fast to come back most of the time, you know. And heckling is either people, there's different types of hecklers. Like there's a drunken, you know, heckler that doesn't know what they're saying. Then there's like an asshole, you know, and then there's like, they're all like kind of assholes, but then there's like just somebody who's trying to outsmart the comedian. So there's like basic heckles that you get. They're like hack hecklers, you know, they're hacks in their heckle, you know? So it's not like they're out there thinking out of the box necessarily. I very rarely have seen that where people are thinking out of the box heckling you. It's usually pretty much basic heckle or a basic, you know, type of way it's usually screaming out usually just like, and you make fun of them, I guess. They just scream out crazy stuff or they try to interrupt, right, which is rude, you know? Mm-hmm. So very rude.
So yeah, doing comedy and, you know, acting, and what was your, like, besides, would you consider was it Grandma Sylvia's funeral? Was that your best paying job to date at that point?
No, it was my most well-known. Mm. It was decently paid. It wasn't the best paid. I did a little, I actually, you know, film stuff is paid a lot better. So it was an equity contract at the time, the end. But it actually wasn't a great contract looking back on it. It was very, you know, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. And a lot of people had to do day jobs. We had to do other jobs. It was, you know, and this was a real play. So it wasn't like something, it was 8 shows a week and it was pretty intense. So we were working a lot of hours and people had other jobs. It was, you know, a lot of people did other acting jobs. You know, we did commercials, short films, anything, you know, you can get paid to do, we did during that time.
So in addition to doing acting and comedy, you also found time to be very active in the community. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I started out when I was 16, 17-ish, my senior year. I started doing voter registration for my high school. I would go to the League of Women Voters and get the registration form. So the students that were going to be 18 during the school year or even, you know, that year would be able to vote when voting came along. So I was the interim for that specific situation. So I was able to help students. I was an activist over the years for animal rights, eating disorders, mental health awareness. So I've been doing that for many years. But as a younger person, I was very into voter registration and that the young boy should be heard when it comes to voting. That was one of the things I started out doing.
So how long have you been a comedian / actor, actress?
Oh, well, I've been an actor since I'm 5, you know, since I could talk. I've been a comedian for probably, this is my 19th year. I say 20, but my 19th official year of a stand-up.
So like a lot of us who works in the arts, what did you do last year when the pandemic hit and everything shut down?
You know, at first it was, you know, I had a lot of shows booked, you know, coming into the pandemic. That got obviously canceled. It was funny because we had a great show. I guess it was in late February. It was like a sold out 500 seater. And I was like, this is great. Then I was going to perform somewhere else in that same region in a couple of months. And that was going to be sold out. And then it like, it was like, it's in, I was in LA for about a month or a little bit less. I went to LA, maybe it was a few weeks before the pandemic. I went to Philadelphia. I was traveling, doing work. I had meetings and I was excited to come back. I didn't realize as I was like, you know, hanging out at the beach in LA one afternoon, my friend's writing to me, they're closing everything in China. This virus is coming. Like, oh no. You know, I didn't, you know, it was before anyone had it here. So I was like, what are you talking about? You being crazy. So I flew back. And it was interesting because people were wearing masks on the plane. And I never saw that before. I mean, I saw it before, but it wasn't, you know, that many people on a plane wearing masks prior to, you know, this pandemic. So I came back and I was like, this is weird. And I wasn't wearing a mask anyway, because I didn't even own a mask. You know, it was like, I never even really owned one. So I came back and I was a little freaked out. And then I ended up getting strep throat, which is really interesting because I got really sick. I had been sick, and then I got really sick, and then everything closed, and I was like, what's going on? And then I just, it hit me, like, you know, after like the first month, and I was like, oh, the second month, and then like by May, I was like, what, this is it. Then it, you know, then the reality sunk in, mm-hmm. that, you know, I wasn't sure. I had a show booked in Washington State in August, and I was like, oh, I'll be able to do it. I'm sure I'll be able to do it by August. You know, I didn't, and then I didn't have to even call the booker. Like, it was just like, there was nothing even to say. So I looked online. I was like, the place is closed that I was performing at. So I wasn't even, no one, you know, there was no calls at that point. No one even had to call you to cancel at that point. People just assumed, you know, by the summer, we all assumed these shows were canceled, and they were. And I mean, other states have been opened, but it was sad. You know, it was hard. It's been hard. I mean, I'm not into the Zoom thing, though I've done a charity event here and there for Zoom that, you know, mm-hmm. I don't love Zooming. I don't mind podcast Zooming. I don't like stand-up Zooming. It's very uncomfortable. It's like these little heads and you have to like look at them and they're mute. Some of them are laughing. It's just, it's very uncomfortable.
Wow.
For me, at least. It's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Some people are very good at it. Some people are great at Zoom comedy. I'm just not a great Zoom comic.
Yeah. No, I would think you need to interact and you know, that's one of the things of being a comedian, interacting with your audience, and you can't do that on a Zoom call.
No, you can't. It's, well, you can. It's different. It's like sort of like how you're, let's say there was 20 of you, mm-hmm. 20, not you, but 20 people, and then you would laugh at the same time. It's but it's weird because it's, the timing feels off, and it just, it's, there's a certain, I guess, je ne sais quoi to doing Zoom shows. There are some comedians that have figured it out and they're very good at it. I've seen, and then some are, you know, it's just, it doesn't feel comfortable. Maybe if I did more of them, I'd feel more comfortable, but it's not exactly what I want to do. And clubs are opening up in April. So that's a good thing. So I may or may not be making an appearance. So I'm not sure.
So now the big question is, you know, I've been following you online. I knew that you did comedy, and all of a sudden one day I see that you're running for mayor, and I'm like, is this a new stand-up bit? Like, what's going
on? No, I'm running for mayor. Like, it's real. It's full-fledged, you know, team of a lot of people in the triple digits. I am running. It's a real run. It's 100%, nothing to do with comedy. Actually, like, people have been asking me, is this a party? You know, this, when I first, you know, declared, they were like, is this like a part of your stand up? And is this like a Howard Stern run? He did governor back in the day. I don't know if you remember that. Mm-hmm. You're old enough to remember when Howard ran. I said, no, this is a real run. I've been debating. I'm on, you know, the debate stages with, you know, Eric Adams and Maya Wiley and Yang. I mean, I haven't debated him yet, but he's been in the same debate forums I've been at. So no, I've been debating, writing policy, the whole thing. This is no joke. This is like mayor 101. Like, yeah.
So tell me, what made you decide to run for mayor? How did that become your passion? And what do you plan on doing?
Well, I love New York. It's my city. I grew up here. I was born here. I was raised here. I worked here. I never really worked anywhere else except for LA occasionally. So, and the road, but this is where I've based my home, and I'm passionate about politics. I'm passionate about policy. I believe that there's a way to fix New York There's a lot of cronyism here that we need to get rid of, bureaucracy, zoning that we don't need. We have unfair advantages. There's loopholes that they're giving to the 1% that could be going to, let's say, CUNY, for instance. So there's a lot of things that I'm learning and discovering and writing about that need fixing. And it's not just the pandemic that has been the impetus for my run. It's been my passion to actually, I declared it when I was on radio back in 2015. And, you know, it was kind of a joke. And then I just never really paid attention to it. And then during this pandemic, I spoke to a very good friend of mine, who's a key advisor to my campaign, a man named Larry Sharp, who ran for governor back in the last election. I think it was 2018 that he ran against Cuomo. And he said, you should run. And so I said, okay. And I just declared, I did all my registration with my campaign manager. And here we are today.
You know, it's strange. I've always been interested in politics, but never enough to actually run myself. How did you get into that, and what drove you?
Well, I have a huge amount. I want to, you know, I have a lot of different policy. So my top policies right now are, I want to democratize education in the city. So it no longer comes from the mayor's office, or I tell you, and then I hire somebody to tell you your schools what to do. I want the communities of New York City to choose to vote who and how the schools are run. I want people to be able to choose a type of education that suits them, particularly in the high school, you know, the older students that are going to into the college or the real world or whatever, the job markets. And I think that's really important to start early. Learning self-sufficiency, self-responsibility is very important. So I am very excited about my education plan. I plan to create a mental health awareness and intervention situation, because we have a lot of homeless and addicted right now in the city, which we always did, but it's gotten worse. And mental health is a very big problem for both the people who are, you know, obviously having issues. And there are people right now, just like you and I, suffering from this pandemic. And we're going to come out with a mental health crisis, a huge mental health crisis. So that's something that we are going to have to address. And it may not come out right away, because PTSD always comes out a couple of years later. Like you saw 9/11, with a lot of people having issues a couple of years later. So I believe that needs to, we need to prepare our young people for that, as well as our older people who get forgotten, our elderly that have been lonely and they haven't had their families. So we have a lot on our plate. That's not just the obvious. Obviously bring small businesses back and make sure that they're thriving and back to where they, you know, they were at least, and maybe even better than they were. So we have I believe that New York's gonna have a renaissance of the arts. That's one of my passions, that we're gonna have a huge renaissance and the arts are gonna come back in full-fledged form, not just big commercial, you know, theaters and that, but like small theaters. People are gonna be able to do their one-person show. The sculptor's gonna have their studio. The painter's going to have their gallery. I think we're going to have more sort of less commercialized art, which I'm really excited about. The independent artist, you don't need a lot of money to be a painter. You know, I think that we lost a lot of that over the last 15, 20 years. So from when I was younger, growing up. Mm-hmm. So okay. It's going to be exciting because the art is very healing. Comedy, obviously, is going to come back. We'll see comedy and probably not only clubs, we'll see it in, well, it's always been in bars and restaurants, but we'll see it in all different forms. And I think it's going to be very exciting. More performance art, you know, maybe more odd type artists will come back and feel that they could afford to live here, which I think, you know, we need to get more affordable housing for people. Yeah. And that's one of my goals as well, to make sure that New York is affordable and more functional. I think that New York has been very dysfunctional in our MTA system and our bureaucracy and our innovation. It's time to innovate here and yet keep a little of the good parts of New York, the old school parts that we like so much, the architecture and things like that.
Okay. So I guess the big question is, are you going to continue being a comedian, or is this going to be a full-time job in politics for you?
Well, if I'm mayor, it's a full-time job. I can't promise I'll never tell a joke again, but I definitely, if I, you know, run for mayor and win the mayoral job, it's a lot of work. So I'm not going to be able to go around doing spots, and it wouldn't be quite appropriate, but I hope that I can, my speeches will be funny. But I think humor is healing, you know, so at the very least.
So for those of you who are listening to the show, if you want to vote for Stacey Pressman for mayor, you can do that. Voting starts the June 12th and continues to June 20th. And this is something new. I don't live in New York City, but if you do, you can pick your candidate using ranked choice voting. And here's how it works. With a ranked choice ballot, you get to rank candidates in the order of preference when you go to vote. At first, all the first choices will be counted up. If one candidate has over 50%, then the vote's over. Then that person wins. If not, the last place candidate is eliminated and the vote is redistributed. So, like, let's say you had someone as your first choice and they didn't make it, and you put someone as your second choice, they now become your vote. So your vote's not wasted on someone who basically didn't get in. So that's basically how it works. And hopefully that might be something that will help Stacey in her endeavors to become mayor. All right, Stacey. So this is the part of the show where I like to ask my podcast questions. Questions that I want to know what makes you you, because that's the name of this show, The Quiditas Factor. What is your quiditas? So my first question to you is, with your old profession right now, being a comedian, what's one myth you'd like to debunk right now?
That's an interesting question, Michael. I've never been asked that. What's a common myth? That comedy is hard? No, that it is hard. Mm-hmm. It's not. I think that a common myth about comedy is that people, that hecklers are the problem, which is not really. The problem is writing good material, you know, and being comfortable. So that's a common myth that people ask me, how do you deal with hecklers? Like, that's never been an issue in terms of anybody I know. Like, oh, I get heckled so much, I can't do stand up. You know, the best part, a common myth about acting. I don't know any myths about acting. Tell me a myth and I'll debunk it.
I guess that every actor is rich, or they know.
Growing up, there was a lot of Me Too. That's not a myth. There was a lot of Me Too-ing in the 90s and 80s when I was young, very young. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of like inappropriate talk and, you know, being asked to go to dinner with people that were much older that you wouldn't have dated, that I wouldn't have dated. So that did happen. That was an issue. So the Me Too movement isn't totally wrong. I mean, it wasn't so obvious though. It was more subtle. So it's like having someone force you to, not force you, but ask you, that some, your boss saying, you know, you should go out to dinner with this particular celebrity. Meanwhile, you're 22 years old and they're 60 years old. It just wasn't, and back then I'm like, it's only dinner, but it really wasn't, because then that celebrity talked really disgusting to me, like perverted. I mean, nothing physically happened, but that wasn't, you know, that was being Me Too'd. I shouldn't have, you know, been put in that position or been asked to be put in that position, you know. And then I feel like I wasn't strong enough to say no to my boss because I was just so grateful to have an acting job. So that happened often. So that movement does exist for a reason. And it was, you know, that would never, thank God, happen. Probably now is bad. People are much more self-aware. I mean, they're aware that this exists, so they're not going to force you to do stuff that you don't want to do or go to places that you don't want to go for the wrong reasons, you know, not because I'm showing up to be, you know, make an appearance, but I'm going there to sort of placate this particular celebrity. So they take, like, you know, heed to our show or to whatever the end result was for another reason. So, but comedy, I think it's for everybody now. It's opened up the doors to women. When I started, it was rare. I'd go to places 20 years ago 18 years ago, whatever it was, and they'd be like, we never had a woman here. And now there are lots of women coming in, young women coming in on the scene, which is great. So that's, you know, it's definitely becoming a much more diverse. There's all types of comedians of all nationalities, colors, races, you know, sexual identifications, gender, you know, all that stuff, sexuality. So comedy is quite diverse now in different voices, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, that's a myth that's being dispelled. You know, it's not so rare to see a very different type of comic, a female, whatever it might be. So, yeah. Mm.
You brought up an interesting point about the Me Too movement. I wanted to get your opinion as a woman and also because running for mayor. Do you think there should be a time limit onto what people bring up? Or do you think there's a no holds barred type of thing when that?
I mean, with rape, there's no time limit. Mm-hmm. Or sexual assault or anything like that.
Right.
I think, you know, if someone had, you know, I have beliefs that people do make mistakes. Back 20 years ago, things that were said, it was socially acceptable and doesn't mean it makes it right. But to hold people to the standards of today are very different. Does mm-hmm. that make sense? So,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you know, people don't realize they were doing anything wrong. Like, just like I didn't realize that, oh, maybe I shouldn't be going, I should have said no to going to dinner with this person or hanging out in this situation. I had I could have said no and not be fired, you know, like that type of stuff. So I believe that now there's like straight up sexual assault, the straight up people who've done terrible things, you know, that are scarring. But I think the gray line area where like someone might hit on you because they liked you and they didn't know how to act without, you know, I think that there should be, I guess there should be some sort of time limit on that. I don't think, you know, it should be, and you know, it's also, you know, it's, you know, I think it's, you have to differentiate sexual assault versus someone being like, oh, I like you, I want to kiss you. You know, it's, there's a difference. There's different innuendos, there's gray areas. And there's, I thought you meant this, but you know, there's very different gray areas. And I think we need to look at that too. You know, there are men that like, they would never sexually assault somebody, but they just thought back in that was how you, you know, got a woman to date you or kiss you or whatever it might be. So I don't know. I think each situation is so, I believe that every situation is specific to its own need. So I think each situation needs to be looked at specifically different instead of just grouping it all Me Too.
Right.
You know, there are people Me Tooing because someone went out with somebody and then they didn't call them again. And that's, you know, whatever. And they fooled around by choice with them. And then the person didn't call them again. I mean, what it's, there's different, there's like, what does Me Tooing mean? Like, it has to have, you know, someone sexually assaults you and, or they're your boss or there's someone of power in your life and they have control of your career and they're acting inappropriate. That's a different type of situation. So every situation is so specific and, you know, someone's predatory versus someone who's just a jerk. It's all very different, I believe. And women can meet two men as much as men can meet two women, you know? So I don't think it just goes from men to women, women to men. Gay men could meet to each other and gay women. And so I just think there's like each situation needs to be looked at specifically. And I don't know what time limit should be, but I think it should be, I don't want to say it should be 20 years, but I think that people need to look at the situation as each individual situation. And then the time limit should be like, well, that was really bad. You know, I could probably go back in time and really think of terrible situations, but I don't know if that would serve anybody at this point, except maybe actually addressing it to the people that actually hurt me. So.
Now that's interesting. You mentioned Me Too and the Me Too movement. And there is a fellow comedian out there, Louis C.K. He did admit to being inappropriate with women. What did you think about that? Because unlike other people, he admitted it and he apologized for it, but I believe he's still being demonized for it. And I'm not saying what he did was okay. I'm just wondering if his apology is being accepted. Your thoughts.
So there's many different situations with Louis C.K. That was one with when he masturbated at the hotel and then he did it other times on a movie set with a fellow comic, And she reported it like right then and there. I mean, it's like he wasn't when he the thing that happened. See, it's very weird because he wasn't well known, I think, at the time when he did the hotel situation. But then the other times he was well known. And so it was, I mean, it still was inappropriate. I mean, if I was sitting in a hotel room with another comedian and they started doing something like inappropriate, I would leave.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was what they had the choice to do. It didn't make it right. They weren't in a work situation. So it's a very, those again, blurred lines. So, but they felt maybe they weren't able to leave. I don't know. You know, it was a very, that was an odd situation, but then I think there was other, so many other situations that were 10 times worse or much more where it was like the work environment was, he was intrusive of the work environment and being sexual. So I wasn't there. So I don't like to judge people's Me Too experiences, but yeah, that was a bad, that was a weird, that was a bad situation. No. But again, they could have also left. They said they, I don't know if they felt intimidated or fearful, but he, you know, of his fame, but I don't even think he was that famous at that point. He might've been above them in the comedy world, but I don't know if that makes a difference. I mean, if I was in, someone invited me to the room or, and they started doing something like that, I'd be like, get the hell out of here. Put your pants back up, you know? And if he didn't do it, then it'd be a problem. But if you don't just, I mean, it's inappropriate to start taking your penis out anyway. I mean, let's just be honest. It's not a healthy, normal thing to do.
Right.
I mean, he probably needs sex. He's probably some kind of sex addict. So, I mean, I'm not making excuses for it, but it's not an appropriate thing to do, period. Mm. Particularly with your work people. So I think his whole career should have been shut down because of that incident. Probably not. But for other incidences, definitely probably not career, but he should have addressed it, you know, better. He didn't necessarily totally always address it correctly. So, but he's back. I mean, he does stand up. I mean, I'm not, if he's funny, he's still funny, you know, like, right. So
yeah,
it's like, it's a weird line between someone's character and their art. I think that's a really weird line.
Right. Yeah.
You know, not everyone, we're not all, people are not perfect. You know, people are flawed. Human beings are flawed by nature. So, you know, it's a very tough line to cross, how flawed people are.
Tell me about somebody who touched your heart and how they changed your life for the better.
You know, I have my friends in my life have definitely just made my life better. Like my support systems, I'm an only child. I don't have, you know, a big family. So I have cousins that are really great. My grandmother, definitely. I was very close to her. She passed away about 15 years ago, but I was very close to her. And so she definitely changed my life. She's the one who encouraged me to do acting as a little girl. So I would definitely say my grandmother. So that's definitely, every day I see acts of kindness from people, strangers on the street or in, you know, reading about them. And that gives me faith in humanity. And I think that touches my heart when I see like acts of kindness from people to other people. I always like that definitely changes me and gives me faith.
Is there a funny story that you'd like to share with us about maybe when you're an actor backstage or backstage, you know, before a show?
On the set? I have funny stories. I'm trying to think of a funny story. I have a lot of funny comedy stories going, performing down south. So I, one of my first road tours was deep south, like Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi. Now I'm a girl, I'm a Jewish girl from Brooklyn. Can you, and this was like deep, deep south. And we were driving in Alabama. And we stopped at this like house that had antique. It was like an antique house. It was a house that sold antiques. And it was selling antiques. And we were just like driving in the middle of nowhere going to the next town. And we go inside and it's a house, you know, hoarded looking. He was selling everything. You know, there were toilet seats on the, you know, different toilet seats on the, on the lawn and like crazy, anything you could think, you know, just crazy, like out of a movie. and very creepy man. And he was like something about, he said something about Jesus. And then I said, I'm Jewish, which I don't know why I offered that. He goes, we'll all be going to the same place. I'm like, what's good? And he like pointed upwards. I'm like it was in a very creepy voice. He's, we'll all be going to the same place soon. I'm like, oh, okay. It was like, I thought he was going to murder us or something. It was kind of that voice that we're all going to go in the same place soon or something like that. Well, you know, something like that. We're all going to go to the same place. It was like, it was very eerie. Plus the house was really creepy. And then that tour was so bizarre because then we went to Forsyth, Georgia, and there were all these very racist people and they were screaming racial Jewish thing against Jewish people and Black people. And they were just saying, it was terrifying. There were sheriffs. So I thought I was going to be killed. And my ex-husband, he was half Iranian. So we thought we were going to be like killed. So I was like, this is 2000 something at the time, you know, I think 2005, three, whatever it was. I said, this is a little scary that this is still happening. So it makes you like see, but most of the South was great. I had, you know, other than those incidences, and I was, you have to realize I was a Jewish woman performing stand up. And back then you didn't see that in the Deep South. So that was kind of interesting. So we have a very diverse country with different, you know, I hope that we're much more tolerant and than that tour, but you know, that was scary. That was pretty frightening to see that back then. I never forgot that tour.
If you could turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell her?
Oh, that's a great question. Wow. I would tell her not to self-sabotage so much. Just don't believe in yourself. Like, it's going to be okay. Like, not to hurt yourself so much, not to be so hard on yourself and like accept yourself. Cause I didn't at all. So I think that if I would have told myself that and like, I live by that, I think that it would have helped me not have such difficulty moving forward in my life.
Here's a question for you. Tell me something that people seem to misunderstand about you.
I don't know. Well, I don't know people's perception, but I think sometimes people don't know what my background is. Like people that just met me later in life, they don't know what like I went through as a younger person, how I grew up. Mm-hmm. They're a little clueless. They don't realize. I think that maybe some of that, like where I came from, they don't know that. They think it's different with what I've been told, you know? So I don't know if people really understand my upbringing very much. They assume one thing and it's not. So I think that my upbringing probably.
What's the one thing that stand-up comedy did for you that you didn't expect?
I think stand-up comedy gave me confidence to be able to voice my own opinions, write my own script, formulate my own point of view. Whereas when I was an actor, I would read your script, do the acting, play that part. I was very, I was always being somebody else. When I do stand up, I think stand up allowed me to be myself for the first time. It was very healing for me because humor is healing. But then also being like, I never played a character on stage. I always was very much me. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, there's people that have like funny characters. I mean, not that I don't act out characters sometimes, but I don't have a stand up persona that's not me. You know, there are people that have stand up personas that are just not them at all. But my persona is very much me. So it allowed me to be very much who I am. And then I started doing, you know, motivational speaking through the stand-up and traveling the country. So it helped with that. So I think it allowed me to become more authentic.
So as you know, the name of this show is called The Quiditas Factor, and quiditas means the whatness or essence of a thing or person. But to make it easy on you, let's just say that quiditas means magic power or superpower. What is your magic or superpower? What is your quiditas?
I would say what I think that my superpower would be my empath is very strong. So it's damagingly strong. So I don't know if it's a superpower, but my empath is very strong. Like, and I think that would be my superpower. Out of everything I have in my life, my empathic nature or my empathic abilities are strong. And I don't know where it came from or why, but it's just getting feelings and vibes and things like that of people, understanding their emotions and how they are. I have that ability, and it's not always good because sometimes it's not always good emotions coming through. So, yeah.
Finish this sentence for me. I believe.
I believe that people underestimate their abilities, and I believe that people need to also believe in themselves more, because I guess I'm speaking for myself. I believe you need to believe in yourself more. And when you believe in yourself, other people will come along for the ride.
And my final question of the day for you is, what does the future hold for Stacy Pressman?
Wow. The future holds a position as mayor of New York City. Mm-hmm. Hopefully. And I hope the future holds just a lot of beautiful people around me, hopefully. I mean, inside and, you know, beauty, people with great intentions and a great heart. That's what I hope the future holds.
Stacy, thank you so much for joining me on the show. For those of you who are listening, you could reach Stacy on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Stacy, can you take us out?
My name is Stacy Pressman, and you're listening to The Quiditas Factor.
Thank you for listening to The Quiditas Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbouet. Before I let you go, please check out my website at www.mikearbouet.com. That's MikeArbouet.com. And you can check out my shop. There you'll see a shop called Arbo Artifacts, where I have some t-shirts for sale that will help the show, as well as my wife's Etsy store, which is called Poem Jewelry Design. And Poem actually stands for Power of Each Moment. So please check out that store, because she sells a lot more than jewelry there, and it's really cool and amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I'm her husband. I'm saying it because it's true. And finally, if you can, please become a patron. Thank you for the people who are patrons so far. And I hope to see everyone join if they can. And please join me every Tuesday for a new episode of The Quiditas Factor. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiditas Factor with Michael J. Arbouet. We'll catch you next time.